Happy to welcome everyone this afternoon. This event is designed to coincide with the publication of a new book edited by myself and Patrick Diamond called The New Egalitarianism. In this book, we argue that our society can be more egalitarian, our society can be more inclusive. Indeed, we argue our society must become more egalitarian, it must become more inclusive. But we argue that a new egalitarianism must be compatible with aspiration and must be compatible with wealth creation and job creation. This event is sponsored jointly by the LSE and Policy Network. Policy Network is a think tank which organizes meetings for social democrats who come from around the world to network with one another. Policy Network is run by Matt Brown. It also organizes the progressive governance meetings which happen once a year when political leaders come together to discuss progressive governance. Policy Network also was the foundation of the book that we've produced because it was through Policy Network that the seminars were organized, which led to this estimable volume being produced. Now let me turn to our distinguished guest, who I'm very pleased and honored to welcome here this evening. Senator Edwards is known to everybody. He had a distinguished career in the law before moving into politics and becoming senator for North Carolina. He was the vice presidential candidate, Democratic candidate, for the presidential election of the United States in 2004. As I understand it, he's recently, to some extent, moved into the academic world and has become a part-time professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and is the head now of a new center on poverty, work, and opportunity, also at the University of North Carolina. Well, I would say he's a perfect person to speak about the new egalitarianism, even though he might not recognize the concept itself. And I'd like you, please, to give him an extremely warm LSE welcome. It's very good of him to come.
Thank you, Lord Giddens. It's a great honor for me to be here at this extraordinary institution and to be able to share this time with all of you. I want to talk today about the new world in which we all live, and the challenges we face and what we need to do together to meet those challenges. In the final days of 2004, right after Christmas, as most of you will remember, we witnessed destruction on a human scale that reminded us of two things. One is that every one of us is mortal, and second is that in this world we are all connected. We saw images by the thousands of what happened as a result of the Asian tsunami. Small villages existed one minute, then they turned into piles of splintered wood the next. Tourists walked along the beach, and seconds later they were holding on to the tops of trees. We saw trains moving, and then moments later, those trains bent as if they were made of plastic. We saw children playing with their parents, and moments later, parents looking to empty hands and grieving. We saw miles of destruction, piles of bodies. Words like catastrophic seem small when they're compared to the massive destruction that affected eight countries, killing 280,000 people, with thousands more still missing. It was a day when the new world seemed slowly to come into focus in a very, unfortunately, very mournful way. This was not Indonesia's national disaster. It was not Sri Lanka's national disaster. It was not Thailand's national disaster. It was the world's disaster. And it was the world's to mourn, and it was the world's to respond to and to repair. And it took a moment for the world to internalize this. But soon after, food and water arrived, temporary shelters went up, and then the hard work began. Bridges were rebuilt, new boats were delivered to fishing villages that had lost their boats, and slowly, millions of people were able to resume their lives. When eight countries in one region of the world are affected by such an extraordinary event. Their economies are threatened, and so are ours. When hundreds of thousands of children are orphaned, living in tents and temporary shelters, their despair and their disillusionment is a threat to their stability and to our security. For disillusionment is, in fact, the fuel, as all of us have seen much too often recently, that feeds the fire of hatred and tyranny. And when millions of people, men and women, who used to be able to work and support their families, are today at risk of falling and slipping into poverty, it is the moral conscience of the world that gives those people hope. And when we remember that natural disaster, the tsunami in Asia, we can't forget the man-made disasters that are happening right now in places like Sudan. You know, we watch the horrors in Darfur, and we ought to all feel appalled and ashamed. This world's inaction is making all of us look as if we don't care what's happening in the killing fields of Sudan. You know, we said, I thought, never again after the Holocaust. We said never again after Rwanda. Never again means nothing if we don't do something about what's happening in Sudan right now. And these events all remind us that we are not alone, that our blessings also give us an enormous responsibility. Your great leader and America's great friend, Winston Churchill, spoke about a gathering storm before the tyranny that took over and resulted in World War II. Today, with the new global challenges we face, these storms are gathering again. These storms are gathering to the east, to the west, to the south. Some have already reached America and Europe in the form of terrorism and poverty, but others are slowly building strength, and they will hit us like a hurricane. And they will change the way this world looks 20 years from now and beyond. It is the job of our leaders, in fact, it's the job of every one of us, to understand what those challenges are and to prepare for them. For example, right now we see new global players emerging. Some historians refer to the last century as the American century. The 21st century could very well belong to Asia. China and India aim to win a race to the top, and not, as I'll talk about further, not simply by taking our low-paying jobs. Some believe that China's GNP, gross national product, will soon surpass all other countries except America. India's will grow at a similar pace. China and India's rise in the global economy and their emergence as more prominent players militarily and politically will have an enormous impact on America, Britain, the EU, and transatlantic relations. And I don't think we've even begun to understand the consequences. We've also not fully grasped the changes that come as a result of the spread of information technology. Thanks to new technology and the power of knowledge in the world, this world is shrinking every single day. But globalization brings challenges to all of us. For example, how do we ensure that the great divide between the haves and the have-nots starts to actually close? How do we lead so that developing countries understand that education and market reforms and just governments can actually bring hope in the place of desperation? And in our world of such wealth and promise, we can't forget another issue and another huge challenge for all of us, which is the extreme poverty that exists on this planet. Close to half the world's population, more than 3 billion people, live on $2 or less a day. How do we address this absolutely unthinkable human suffering? How do we win the hearts and minds of young people, the millions struggling in Africa, or those kids who are struggling as a result of the tsunami? How do we reach them so that they can climb out of this life of hopelessness and despair? The time has come for all of us, to fight global poverty. We also need to summon the creativity and the will to address the storm that's gathering to threaten all of our collective security. The threat from the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, this threat is not new. North Korea is moving forward with their nuclear program. Iran, as we know, and the negotiations and discussions are going on today, has its own nuclear ambitions, and so do the terrorists. Imagine if one of those weapons actually got in the hands of a terrorist and were used in either New York or Washington or London. These gathering threats will not face a single country or a single region of the world. They face all of us. And we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing? Are we doing enough to eliminate this threat? The answer to that question is no. And today, many ask whether America and Europe can continue to work together to ensure that we spread democracy around the world. The answer to that question has to be yes. We must work together. And the moment, this is the moment when we have to strengthen our partnership to ensure that in the 21st century, we move toward liberty and opportunity everywhere. It's time to make a single promise to our children that we will work together to build a world that welcomes them in the year 2020 and beyond, that we'll have a secure world in which we all can thrive, and through education, democracy, and development, that we're going to have the tools to do exactly that. Working together, free nations have to help build a world that says no to vengeance and hatred and no to genocide. A world that makes learning and education a necessity and a right, just like light and water and food. A world that no longer races toward weapons of mass destruction. And a world where young people no longer feel disillusioned, so disillusioned, that they strap on a bomb and kill innocent people. And a world where tyranny falls and democracy rises. Together, we can achieve these goals. The question, though, is how? How do we reform what happens inside our own countries? And how can we work together to move forward and strengthen our ideals? I want to talk today about four pillars that I think we can build on to help to develop this just new world that we believe in. First, America and Europe have to do more to prepare for the challenges of globalization. Our place in this world is not preordained. Countries like China and India are not in a race to get our low-wage jobs. They are in a race to be on the cutting edge of innovation and technology. These young men and women, they're being educated as never before. They're studying engineering and science. They understand that the next wave of biotechnology, nanotechnology, and other information technology is key to their success personally and to their nation's success. They've learned that in order to be an economic power and a leader, the ticket is innovation. And through the EU, Europe is transforming to deal with this new reality. Now, I know we're going to find out, I guess, what happens Sunday in France. I know that looking from a distance, from America, that the challenge has been great in moving forward with the EU. But I want to make it clear that it is in America's interest for the EU to succeed. We need a strong European partner. And just as Europe is undergoing dramatic change, America also has to act to ensure that we remain strong. We can't solve the world's problems if we are not strong at home. And in our country, we need reform. We need reform to our own education system. Today, too many young people are being blocked from the opportunity to go to college because they can't afford to pay for it. Fewer and fewer low-income students are able to attend our universities. We need to reform our own student aid programs. We need to cut subsidies that today are flowing to banks and ensure that every child who works hard is able to attend at least the first year of college free. No one should be shut out in America from an education just because they can't afford it. Another great threat to our competitiveness in America is our healthcare system. America has some of the best health care in the world, but we also have 46 million people who are uninsured and don't have access to health care. And if you look at what this health care does to America's ability to compete, a car made in America has about $1,400 of health care costs in it. In Japan, the same cost is about $600. This is just one of the reasons we need desperately to make sure that health care is available to every American and that it's affordable. And it's imperative that our country get our fiscal house in order. Living in deficit is not good for our families, and it is not good for our country. It diminishes our independence. It diminishes our economic security. We become dependent on other nations who hold our debt. Right now, China's purchased nearly $300 billion of America's debt. These low-interest loans have made the impact on this huge deficit that we now have minimal. But that's just for now. When China changes its policies, it could have a devastating effect on the American economy. Interest rates could go up, consumer spending could drop. Those interest rates could mean people can't afford their homes anymore, a substantial increase in the number of bankruptcies. Budget deficits have made America less competitive. There's less money to invest in innovation and research and to meet the challenges that we face with education and health care. And there's more risk when we rely on another country for our economic security. So we in America must balance our budget. It's imperative. Even if we take these steps, and even if we maintain our global leadership, it's meaningless if millions of children grow up in our countries grow up poor. America is, I know, often known as the richest country in the world, but the truth is that 25% of our families in America, one out of four, either live in poverty or live near poverty, right at the margin. And that's why the second pillar of what we have to do to ensure that we build the world that we believe in is to fight poverty and to fight it dramatically in our own countries. We will not persuade other countries to honor our ideals unless we are an example and we honor them ourselves. Like Britain, America is a place that believes that one person can rise from a modest background and have a dramatic effect not only on our own nation but on the rest of the world. We actually believe that we all have the same worth, that a doctor and a bus driver have equal worth. They have different jobs, but through their hard work, they can change things. This is what we believe. But the best evidence that America is not living up to its ideals, the fact that we have 36 million people who wake up every single day in poverty, in a country of our wealth and our prosperity. There are children who have no hope just because of where they live and the family they're born into. There are people who are working two jobs and still aren't able to make ends meet. And too many families, and unfortunately I've been meeting with them over the last several months, too many families spend every night in homeless shelters. Earlier this year, in January, I went to a little place in eastern North Carolina to meet, a little place called Little Washington, to meet with, they don't think of themselves as Washington, I promise you, to meet with folks who were struggling and having a difficult time. And there was, I'll never forget this, there was a woman sitting at the end of the table, and she was articulate, made a great presentation, and she told me about having worked for years and years to support her kids, to support her family. And then she lost her job. As a result of losing her job, she'd lost her home, and now she was living in a shelter. She's looking desperately for work, but not able to find it. And she said, "The day before you came here, Senator, I went in to the local laundromat to get in and out of the cold." And she said, "I walked in, and there was a woman there who sort of looked down at me, and she said, 'You know, I recognize you. You're one of those people from the shelter.'" And she said, "Yes, ma'am, I am." And she said, "Well, you know, all those people who live in the shelter are just trash." You know, the truth of the matter is that some of us understand how lucky we've been. You know, how one bad year or one bad event could have put us in exactly the same place that woman was in. But in too many places around the world, some of us want to ignore those who are struggling. Some of our leaders want us to believe that we're in this alone. That if you made it, you know, that's your success. And if you failed, if you didn't make it, that's your failure. It is not the truth. No one succeeds alone. Whether it's in America, here in Britain, it just doesn't happen. We succeed because in some cases we have laws that do in fact protect private property. We succeed because we have good schools and good universities, public schools, public universities, that allow us to get the education that we need. And we succeed because we do embrace values like hard work and responsibility. I know this from my own personal life. Now, those of you who watched the American presidential campaign might remember, this probably won't be news to you, that I'm the son of a mill worker. But it is the truth. It is the truth that I actually was brought. My father did have to borrow $50 to get me out of the hospital to bring me home to a little two-room house in a mill village. My parents did work in the mill. My grandparents lived up the street, and they worked in the same mill. And I was lucky. You know, we worked hard, probably like most of you and like these people that I've been meeting with who are struggling. We worked hard, but things broke the right way for us. And because of good luck and hard work, I was able to go to college, to be the first person in my family to actually go to college. And Lord knows I've been blessed with everything anybody could ever have at this point in my life. But these people that I've been talking to, they work hard. They're responsible. They care about their kids and their family. You know, the bottom line is we need to do something about the millions of people who live in poverty, in my case, in America, the 36 million who live in poverty, not just because it's an economic issue, but because it's wrong. We have to ensure that our children have the education that they need to compete and be able to lift themselves out of poverty, that our societies have the capability to help everybody, not just people at the top, but all those who are struggling every single day. And we have to have capital available for our inventors and for our dreamers, and they have to have access to the capital. These people who are out there struggling and doing everything right, they need us. They need us to do the right thing. And I've been talking in America about taking some steps to help eradicate poverty that exists in our country. And many of them actually are similar to some of the things that are being done here by Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. Let me start by saying we should first shine a bright light on the problem. It's been far too long in America since the American people have focused on the millions of people who are living in poverty. We have 13 million more today than we had 30 years ago. The reality is that good people from all backgrounds, all political parties, all ideologies, they will do the right thing, but somebody has to bring them there. Somebody has to touch them about this issue. The second thing we need to do, besides just focusing attention on it, is we need to make work pay again. You know, we have to understand, as I think we do in America, that it's hard work that made America what it is today. And men and women who have worked with their hands and with their heads, and they still do, really all they want is for our country to be the land of opportunity again. And that's why we're fighting so hard to end what I think is a national disgrace, which is the minimum wage that exists in America today. It hasn't been raised since the 1990s. It hasn't even remotely kept up with inflation. And we ought to expand the earned income tax credit, much as your government has done with the working tax credit. Bill Clinton did it in the 1990s, helped lift millions of people out of poverty. As a result, there are still holes in what needs to be done. We need to eliminate the marriage penalty in the earned income tax credit. We need to make it available to single people. I mean, we've created with this earned income tax credit a disincentive for people to be married. It's a mistake. We need to expand the use of the earned income tax credit. We also need to strengthen the foundations for families. And that means, in our country, health care for everybody and child care for parents who need it. And finally, we need to make sure that families aren't just getting by, that they're actually getting ahead. And that means we need to help them create assets so they have something to fall back on. We had a discussion at UNC Chapel Hill several weeks ago, and an expert was talking about this issue. And he said, you know, income disparity is an enormous issue, but income is what you use to get by. Assets are what you use to get ahead. Assets are what you use to fall back on if something goes wrong. And asset creation is important. That's why your country has actually led the way with the child trust funds, the baby bonds. You know, we ought to consider doing the same thing in America, creating an account for a child that's born, $500, say, and providing a matching amount for what the family is able to put into that account over the years. You know, the truth is that if it's done and it's done right, it can create an account for up to $40,000 when that child turns 18, money they can spend on college or a home or to start their own small business. Imagine what it says to a poor child in America, or actually here either, but imagine what it says to them that they know that if they study hard, if they do the right thing, they will absolutely have the money to get the education that they need, that they'll have the money to help them buy a home, to provide them with some level of financial security. It can change entire communities, not just individual families. So these are some very real and fundamental ways in which we can prevent families from falling into poverty, and that's exactly why I started the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the University of North Carolina. After the campaign, after the election was over, we talked about, you know, we all have choices in our lives about where we want to spend our time. This was near and dear to my heart. In fact, it was before I ever got involved in politics, and this is a place where I hope we can make a difference. And this center is actually going to focus on the ideas, the new creative ideas, including some of the things that are being done right here that can be used to fight poverty. And while I focused at this center on domestic poverty, we also have an enormous responsibility to fight extreme poverty around the world. One of the reasons that I'm here today and was here yesterday was to hear your ideas about how we can help lead them on this issue. And the British government has actually shown enormous leadership in fighting global poverty, particularly in Africa. It is unacceptable that by many measures, Africa is actually poorer today than it was 25 years ago. I believe that America and the world ought to actually draw some inspiration from what you're doing right now. We have an important role to play, and we ought to play that role. I'm talking about America now. For too long, the struggles in Africa have been overlooked. Along with other countries in the UN, we ought to be leading the effort to do simple things, like buying mosquito nets to protect children from malaria, ending school fees and uniform fees that prevent poor children from being able to go to school, making sure farmers have the tools they need to grow decent crops, give women the right to own property. These are simple steps, but they could have an enormous effect in Africa. It is time to move forward on these things. It's time to move forward, not just because it's in our interest, it's in America's interest, it's in Britain's interest to do it, but we ought to do it because it is the right thing to do. It shows the kind of leadership that America and Britain can provide when they're willing to do simply what's right. The third pillar that we have to build in order to develop a just world for America and Europe is to work together to eliminate the threat of weapons of mass destruction. We know that our enemies want these weapons, and we know that most of these weapons and bomb-making materials are not secure, particularly in Russia and in the other states for the former Soviet Union. Terrorists could get their hands on these weapons, and we can't wait another day to secure them. The international community needs also new tools to fight the spread of weapons of mass destruction. It is time today to close the loopholes in the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And we also ought to create what I would call a global nuclear compact, where we bring the leading nations of the world together to make sure that we do close the loophole that allow civilian nuclear programs to get right up to the edge and then go military. It'll keep these materials and capabilities out of the hands of people who would do us harm. America and Europe also have to ensure that we have the know-how to build nuclear weapons and other weapons of mass destruction never reaches terrorists. And we can strengthen existing plans that ensure that nuclear scientists are employed for peaceful purposes, so they won't be available. And we can provide safety and security to scientists who are working on weapons programs in rogue nations. Just as all of us came together after World War II to battle the world's great threat, communism, this is what we have to do today to build a safer world. We need critical organizations like NATO to remain strong. The truth is, there will be times when military action is necessary, and we have to be ready. We also need to ensure that NATO continues to transform and is ready to meet the challenges of the 21st century. For example, NATO right now should be providing support for the African Union troops to end the genocide, and it is a genocide, in Sudan. And you can clap for that. And finally, we have to build the final pillar by promoting liberty and democracy around the world. Last week in Washington, your Foreign Secretary, Jack Straw, spoke about standing together to promote what he called a larger freedom. I agree. Ordinary men and women from Egypt to Morocco to Indonesia need to be convinced that liberty and democracy are, in fact, a pathway to possibilities. General John Abizaid, head of U.S. military forces in the Middle East, has said that this war against terrorism is as much a battle of ideas as it is a military battle. Just as poverty and disillusionment isolate and drain hope from our own people in our own cities and towns, it does exactly the same thing for every person around the world who feels like they have no chance, that they have no hope at all. If given the opportunity, these young men and women could do what so many others have done in the past. They could pull down the great books from the shelves in libraries, they could exchange ideas with others from different countries, and they could begin to move their country out of the fog of hate that they live in today. This is the power of liberty and democracy. If given the chance, it stirs the soul and makes all people long for that fundamental human right to be free. In a world where poverty and despair are accepted is a world that's going nowhere, and it's also a world that can never really be free. If you think about it, freedom is meaningless if your child is dying of preventable diseases like malaria. Freedom is meaningless to a child that shows up at the school bus but is turned away because they don't have the uniform to go to school. And freedom is meaningless when 1 billion people on our planet live on $1 or less a day. You know, there's been as I know all of you know. There's been a lot of talk about freedom in America and around the world. I want to be clear about something. The idea that America stands for freedom is not new, and it does not belong to any political party, and it is not owned by any one country. The truth of the matter is it's an idea that was born from our words and our wishes, and it's given life through what we do, through our actions. And we've not acted enough. Our work is not finished. You know, we should ask ourselves, that child that's going to bed tonight in the Sudan starving, is she free? And what about the woman who wanted to vote in the election in Saudi Arabia but wasn't allowed to vote? Why? Because she's a woman. Is she free? And what about the man who wanted to worship, the Christian who wanted to worship in China but wasn't allowed to because he wasn't permitted to in China? Is he free? And how about, remind myself, how about the man in Russia who's in jail and the only reason he's in jail is because he spoke up and he told the truth? Is he free? You know, the truth of the matter is that good nations have to bind together to fight for freedom and to fight against tyranny around the world. But you can't just do it with muscle. You have to do it with moral clarity. And that means with us being the kind of ideal and representing the kind of ideal we should for the rest of the world. And starting with never turning our backs with people within our own borders who are struggling every single day just to get by. And we can't look away from the one-third of the Arab men who are under the age of 18. You know, they're entering a world that lacks job, lacks opportunity. So where do they turn? Who do they turn to for hope? In Saudi Arabia, there are 8 men under 15 for every one between the ages of 45 and 60. Who are they listening to? And what about the young Muslim women in cities across Europe for whom Osama bin Laden is a hero? Our goal for the next decade should be to convince the next generation that our ideals are correct, they are real, and that they offer hope, not just to us, but to the entire world. This is what we can do together. And when we build these pillars, when we promote liberty and democracy, when we eliminate the threat from weapons of mass destruction, when we end poverty, and when we ensure that our countries are prepared for the global economy, then we can build the just world that all of us dream about. And when we do that, we will move toward that moment when our image of democracy as this shining beacon of freedom is respected and looked up to once again in the world. I want to finish today with just a few words about a country that I know the best, America. You know, as an American, I think we have an enormous responsibility to show the world that our country is doing all that it can to fulfill its promise. Not just with our words, but with what we do, with our actions. And not just at home, but in the world. Americans live in a country that's built on the ideals of freedom and opportunity and equal treatment for everybody. I work every day to make sure that our country's trying to meet those ideals. I'm proud of my country. It has blessed me and my family in ways that I could never have imagined. And it's often said that America is as much an idea as it is a country. Well, I want the world to see that promise as much as I see it. I want the world to see that America is working every day to live up to what was written, that all people are created equal, that we all have certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness. And this is actually what we started more than 2 centuries ago, really a great experiment in the history of mankind, where ordinary citizens gathered in their churches, in their stores, in their homes, to pursue a greater good, civic in its purpose, human in its hope. It gave the farmer the same rights as the president. And it gave the blacksmith the same rights, the same opportunities as the ship merchant. And it gave the men and women who said we had not, in fact, honored our ideals, the right to speak up, in fact, more than the right, the responsibility to speak up and say so. America is a place that believes in ascension and believes in the dignity of hard work. This is what we believe. This is what I believe. And every day, we give a person the chance to lift themselves up, whether they're living in Los Angeles or London or Lusaka. We increase the chances of a just world. This is what we can do when we never forget that we are, in fact, connected. That when countries achieve liberty and economic strength, it helps all of us. And that when tragedy happens thousands of miles from our door, it hurts all of us. This is what we must never forget as we move forward. This is what gives our pillars the strength. And this is at the heart of our promise to those children who are resuming their lives after the tsunami. Remember that young boy has just put his new fishing boat in the water. He's got hope again. He's trying to make his way in the world, and he's counting on all of us to steer him toward his dreams. Thank you all very much.
Well, thank you. We do have a fair amount of time for discussion, actually, and questions. And, well, I'm going to lob the first question in, if only to stop other people asking it. And the question is, why didn't you win in 2004? And what should the Democrats do to win next time?
Boy, I got a long way before that question was asked. Let me say a couple of things. One is, and this comes from the heart, I am proud to have been on the ticket that I was on. John Kerry is a good man. He would have made a terrific president. And I will always look back with great pride on having been in this campaign and on this ticket, and our cause was righteous. Now, I'm going to let the pundits hyper-analyze what happened in the last campaign. I mean, there are a lot of things that are just obvious, 9/11, the effects of 9/11, the war in Iraq. But we, going to the second part of your question, we as Democrats, and I think John would share this view, I think what's critical for us, I've now spent 3 years traveling the country listening to what people say, is what people want in their leaders is they want strength. Strength comes from conviction. Strength comes from having a core set of beliefs that you can convey and will get up fighting for every day, and that people know you will fight for every day. And I think it's, at the end of the day, not that complicated. I think we make it more complicated than it needs to be. And I've listened to some of these, what I call yappers on television, since the election, giving us great advice about what we need to do, how we need to nuance and change our positions, how we need to navigate our way through the political landscape more effectively, make ourselves more appealing to more people. I can only speak for this Democrat. I think those people are dead wrong. I think what we ought to do is stand up with strength and passion for the things that we believe in, stand up for our ideals. I know what those are. I know who it is I'm fighting for. I know why I became a Democrat. I became a Democrat so that people who grow up the way I grew up and in much more difficult circumstances than I grew up get the same kind of chances that I got. It's not all that complicated at the end of the day. And so I think if what we need to do is long and short, is go out there and fight for the things we believe in and not start nuancing and changing our positions.
Well, thank you. Can I ask everyone who asked a question to wait till the roving mic gets to them and to identify themselves? And please ask short questions, if you would. Should we start with you in the middle there, gentleman in the middle there? The mic doesn't seem to be getting to you at the second. It's in the perhaps not a very good choice.
I can repeat the question.
Well, it better be a good question after all.
Hi, I'm Cameron McLaughlin, postgrad at LSE and from Fayetteville, North Carolina, so I'm very proud to have you here and say
Thank
I voted
you.
For you twice.
My question
is regards, you made some excellent, correct remarks about the Sudan and the tragedy occurring there and the hypocrisy of the Bush administration for pointing out that it's a genocide and then doing nothing significant about it. How can you put Africa back on the U.S. agenda when all the foreign news in the U.S. is basically about terrorism in the Middle East?
Well, I think this is a place where leadership matters. I mean, it matters whether, I spoke about the in the speech about the challenges of of living in this global world, this global economy. And, you know, if we don't have leaders who, number one, are willing to think in a visionary way and talk to the American people in a visionary way about the challenges we face as a nation and looking forward, not just a year, 2 years, 10 years from now, but 20 years from now, about how we're going to deal with those challenges. Things like more investment in graduate education and the sciences, math, technology. Things like inspiring a new generation of younger Americans, Americans to be interested in those areas. I mean, at the end of the day, education is the key to us being able to compete. And on the issue of Africa, I think that this is a place where you have to appeal to people's sense of what's right and what's wrong. It is, in fact, in our economic interest to do something, and not only about Darfur and what's happening in Sudan, but also what's happening with the disease and poverty that exists in Africa. But I think more importantly, what Americans will respond to is it simply the right thing to do. And I think that if they have a leader who calls on them to engage in something that's more important than their own self-interest, they will do that. And I think that opportunity has existed since September the 11th. It's still sitting out there just waiting for it to happen. And I think that's something we need to make happen.
Thank you. Can we have a question from up the top there? Maybe at the end of the line, that would be a much better strategy.
Senator, thank you for coming here. My name is Salah Madhu. I'm a law student here. I agree with many things that you said, but it seems like you leave out the important bits about things like Abu Ghraib, torture memos, Guantanamo Bay. How can America build a world of liberty and freedom when it denies these people the basic liberties and freedom that every human being should get? Yes. Secondly, how can you leave out Israel in Middle East and say that, no, they don't have weapons of mass destruction? They're not oppressing, suppressing, and humiliating people for the last 55 years. So, I mean, these are important issues that have to be talked about. What do you think about them?
I hear some division in the audience on those issues. I think on the issue of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo, John and I both said, and many others, including, I have to say, Republican leaders, said during the course of the campaign, no one in America is proud of what happened at Abu Ghraib. I mean, I'll speak for myself, it represents what we in America believe in. You know, in times of war, things happen that you're not proud of sometimes, and I think that's what happened. And we denounced it. It was the right thing to do. You don't agree with that? No, it was. Well, now you're going to a different subject. If you're talking about what happened in Abu Ghraib, let me finish. I said during the course of the campaign that it is wrong for America. This is not something that I'm saying today to you for the first time. That I said during the course of the campaign that it was wrong for us to hold people, including American citizens. We were holding our own citizens, enemy combatants, without the right to a trial, or so-called enemy combatants, as the administration called them, without a right to recourse, without a right to hearing, without having any opportunity to show that they had done nothing wrong and they were innocent. I believed that then. I believe it now. It's the right thing to do. Unfortunately, I was not the President of the United States, so I didn't get a chance to set that policy. Yes, of course. I've spoken up on this. I have consistently spoken up on this from both during the campaign through today. And it is my own view that for America to be the kind of ideal that it needs to be to promote freedom and democracy around the world, we have to stand up for those rights ourselves, including when we're holding prisoners in a place like Guantanamo.
Maybe the gentleman in the red shirt over there. Just in that sort of third row from the back.
Thanks. Just a quick comment.
Can I ask just one question rather than a spatter of questions, if you will?
No, it's just one. And Carlos, PhD in economic history. My question is about morality and egalitarianism. I mean, as Christians, you and me believe that only God can give and take life. But I didn't really see you in total opposition against the death penalty. So my question is, what is stronger in you? This heretic egalitarianism, putting not only men at the same level, but men and God at the same level, or your own Christian beliefs?
You know, can I tell you, I spent 20 years as a courtroom lawyer. You'd make a great courtroom lawyer. That's what sort of the one of those, there's no good answer to that question the way you phrased it. Listen, I understand that the death penalty is not popular here. And I guess that's an understatement, right? My own view, which will not be popular here, is that there are some crimes that deserve the ultimate punishment. And I've always believed that. I believe it today. You're entitled to disagree with me. It is just what I think. That doesn't mean that I think the system works the way it should. It doesn't mean that we've got it exactly right. We don't. It doesn't mean that that all people who are charged with crimes punishable by the death penalty get adequate counsel. It doesn't mean that all people are treated equally in a courtroom. It doesn't mean that the process works the way it should in certain circumstances. I'm the first to say that that's not true. And there are lots of things that we have worked really hard to do something about. But this is a fundamental issue of what you believe is right and what you believe is wrong. Very good people disagree with me about this. And I respect their right to disagree. I'm not God, you know. I don't know. I only know what I believe. And I do believe that there are some crimes that deserve the ultimate punishment. Those men who dragged James Byrd behind a pickup truck in Texas, I don't know if you know about the case, it was a horrible hate crime, a horrible, horrible hate crime. They deserve the death penalty. At least in my view, they deserve the death penalty.
Can we have someone maybe from up, maybe you're right at the back there at the top, on my left? Again, if you would, a fairly short and to the point question.
My name is Wolfgang Deckers, and I studied at LSE decades ago. So I keep it very, very short. With all due respect, I thought you were joking half the time when you were talking about equal opportunities. For example, I'm sure you didn't talk about the native Indians who got the vote after the Second World War. And you can't have talked about equal opportunities when you talked about women or blacks who couldn't drink from the same fountain a couple of years ago in the 60s, which is, for me, you know, a short time ago. And this is just domestic. Of course, I could also talk about Nicaragua or Grenada or many other things and talk about equal opportunities. But you wanted a question. And so my question is, if I understood you correctly, and maybe I was wrong, you said with hard work one could change one's position in life. Are you telling me all these people at Kmart don't work hard? Are you telling me that the Bushes and the Kennedys of America have worked hard?
Well, you did manage to add a question onto your speech, and I appreciate that. let me say something about sort of after laying down the damnation, you ask your question. I want to say something about your threshold, the way you laid out the question. I grew up in, you talked about African Americans in the United States. I grew up in the South, and I was born in the early 1950s, grew up there in the 50s and 60s. I saw personally the impact of the things that you're describing. I don't know whether you did. I mean, you're describing them as if you read it somewhere. Maybe you were there. I saw it. I saw it personally, and I take it very personally. And I take personal responsibility for what happened. I think we have a continuing obligation to ensure that those who were the victims of that kind of abuse and discrimination get the kind of opportunities that they ought to have. And so I don't take lightly the kind of comments you just made about people who have been discriminated against in America. It's true. We know it. It was wrong. And some of us, at least, are trying to do something about it. You know, I think spoke out for many years on this subject. So at a time, by the way, I might add, and not in front of audiences like this, in front of audiences where it was not popular, where it was not the popular thing to do, but it was the right thing to do. And I will continue to do that. No, I wasn't joking. I believe in my country, and I believe there's great good in America. Now, do we always do the right thing? No, we don't. Do we make mistakes? Of course we make mistakes. Every country makes mistakes. But the question is, are we out there every day trying to do better? I don't agree with what this administration does on many fronts. It's why John Kerry and I ran to take back the White House from it. And I might add, very close to 50% of the American people don't agree with what this administration is doing. So I can tell you that, speaking for myself, I am proud of the country I live in. I intend to do everything for the rest of my remaining years to cause it to live up to the ideals that I believe in. And the truth of the matter is, we haven't just made mistakes in the past. We're going to make mistakes in the future. So is Britain. So is every other country on the planet. The question is, are you out there every day trying to do better and fighting for the things that you believe in? You know, I can only do what one human being can do, and I don't take responsibility for what the Bush administration does, but I take responsibility for a country that I love very much.
Can you wait for the mic, if you would, because other people in the room can't.
Hi, my name is Nancy Billy.
Sing us a song if you want. Yeah. You have to hold it quite close to make it work.
Anyway, I just wanted to speak here.
That's really better.
Okay. Yeah. I just wanted to ask you, in function of what you just said, in Ohio, when it appeared that discriminatory practices were continuing on a racial basis in terms of the voting.
Yeah.
Do you think there is anything that you could have done after the election to show solidarity with the people who were victims of a kind of a new Jim Crow?
Well, I have been to Ohio multiple times since the election and talked with the very people that you're describing now. The truth of the matter is, and again, this is something that I've spoken about in the past and have spoken about since the election in America, the truth is we have enormous work to do to make sure that our election system, that our democracy, is working the way that it should work. Do I feel a responsibility about that? Absolutely I do. And I think that you know, we should. It's really a pretty simple thing. The very idea that in America people have any reason to doubt their vote, to doubt that they're going to be able to vote, to doubt that their vote was counted, is an outrage. It's wrong. And we have a responsibility to do something about that. We're starting with some simple things, like actually building the best election system that money can buy, which we don't have today, making sure that we have the count of accountability in our election system that we should have. I mean, we're electing what we believe is the leader of the free world. People need to know that when they go to vote, they're not going to have to stand in line for 8 or 10 hours, that they're going to be permitted to vote, have absolutely no doubt that their vote was counted. And do I think we need to do something about that? Absolutely I do.
Thank you.
I've actually heard their stories personally.
I'm just looking for another lady questioner. Yes. Maybe you're in the middle there.
I mean, I know I'm here in London, although I follow the show.
Yes, ma'am.
Can you pop the mic along anyway? Sorry, don't mean to.
Hi, Jennifer Gerber. In reference to your points you made about Darfur and about genocide, you spoke about NATO. I'd just like to hear your views on the UN and the sort of future reform of that. And also, do you think sort of the world state organizations can come together in some way to actually create either a standard or a charter to intervene for interventionism? Because that seems to be the problem at the moment.
Well, the UN is, as you know, I'm sure, the UN is attempting to provide help and to provide aid. I think the problem is there aren't enough AU troops on the ground to provide security, and they don't have some of them aren't trained the way they need to be trained. They don't have the kind of logistical support that they need to be successful. And this is a place where NATO can have a real impact, and NATO should be. It's just, this is something we need to do. And, you know, as I said in the speech, after what happened in Rwanda, I myself believed that the world would never let anything like this happen again. And it's horrendous, and it is a genocide, what's happening there. And I think we have a responsibility to do something about it. You know, the United Nations has a role, to answer your question. The United Nations has a role in that process. But a lot of what's needed there is, in fact, more troops on the ground, more security to just put a stop to it. And this is the place I think that NATO can make a real difference. It can certainly, at a minimum, provide logistical support for the troops that are on the ground and help apply pressure to put more troops on the ground.
A question from somewhere in the middle there, up the top. Lady in the middle there.
Hi. I agree with you in general what we were saying about in your speech. However, you didn't really mention a lot of specifics. And the past week, the New York Times is running a whole series of articles discussing sort of the differences in wealth and disparity in the United States. And I was wondering how, if you could discuss maybe some specifics you've addressed in your program about how you would educate the United States about poverty. And not only in the United States, but on a worldwide level, you know, when you talk to Americans, they think that Africa is a country and not, not a continent. So how do you go about changing their perceptions that people who live in homeless shelters aren't trash, that they are working hard, yeah, that people, you know, can change their situation in life?
Well, the starting place, at least in America, the starting place is to actually make people pay attention to it again. And to understand that the stereotype that exists for so many people who are struggling, you know, that they're irresponsible, they won't work, they don't care for their children, that stereotype is just wrong. That in fact, the people that I've been seeing and meeting with firsthand, the vast majority of them are hardworking. Many of them working two or three jobs, working for minimum wage. They don't have any health care. They don't have any benefits. They're still living in poverty. And I think you have to bring the broader American public to pay attention to this issue, to get beyond activists. I mean, activists who care about this and are engaged and want to do something, it's not that difficult to get them involved. But to get the American people as a whole to support this, they've got to hear the story of good people who are struggling even though they're doing everything right, or they're incapable of helping themselves. And then I think the country will step to the plate. And we have both income disparity issues and enormous asset disparity issues. And going back to the question that the gentleman asked a few minutes ago, there are huge racial factors in our asset disparity in America. If you are an African-American family in America, your average net worth is about $6,000. If you're a Latino family, it's about $8,000. If you're white, it's $80,000. And that gap means something. It means something in the day-to-day lives of these people. They don't own anything. They don't have anything to fall back on. So this discussion about asset creation is not some abstract thing. I mean, we have to find ways, whether it's housing, whether it's matching savings accounts, baby bonds, we have to find mechanisms that create wealth for people. And don't just create wealth, as this administration is great at, create wealth for those who already have it. We need to create wealth for people who are struggling and having a very difficult time. And I think there are a whole variety of ways to do that. It's why I'm actually helping lead minimum wage initiatives. We can't get the Congress to do it, so we're doing it state by state. Florida just did it in this last election. We're leading minimum wage initiatives in Ohio and Michigan and Arizona, a second run through in Nevada because of their constitution. It has to be passed twice to help deal with some of the wage disparities. On top of that, we need labor law reform in America. You know, one of the great anti-poverty movements in American history was the organized labor movement. And we need to empower people to be able to organize so that we don't have employers who violate the law during an organizing campaign. Nothing happens. They get a slap on the wrist 2 or 3 years later. They need to be held accountable for what they do. We need to put the law on the side of working people who are trying to organize, because the reality is that organized labor creates decent wages. They create a reasonable bargaining field. They create benefits. I mean, so we need to provide them with the tools to be able to be effective in their organizing campaign. America's labor movement's been moving in the wrong direction, which most people already know. So I think there are a whole variety of things to deal with, both the wage issue and a deal. I talked about the earned income tax credit, expansion of the earned income tax credit. That combined with an increase in the minimum wage would actually lift millions of people out of poverty. Health care alone, that issue alone is driving many Americans into poverty. Because what happens is, and we just passed this horrendous bankruptcy law, I don't know how many of you followed that, but you know, it was just a complete giveaway to the banks and credit card companies. And the result is, if you're a single mother and you're working two jobs and you have and you don't have health care coverage and you have a child that gets badly sick and you run up a $30,000 or $40,000 medical bill, what this law says, which the Congress passed, is that you're going to carry that debt around with you for the rest of your life. You're never going to be out from under. Talk about hopelessness. And it was just this. And these are the same credit card companies that would send a credit card application to a dog. You know, there's nobody they wouldn't give a credit card to. So, at least from my perspective, that we need to find ways to put the law on the side of people who are living in poverty. Allow them a decent wage. Make sure that they're able to create some assets so that they actually have something to fall back on, so they have something to pass on to their children and their grandchildren. That's how wealth is created.
Maybe someone from down the side, just on the left there. Again, a short question, if you wouldn't mind, because time's getting a bit.
Thank you for coming, Senator Edwards. My name is Lynn Fogarty. I'm a master's student here. My question is, in speaking of minimum wage, as an economics major, I learned a pretty simple formula that raising a minimum wage increases unemployment, as does union contracts. And I'm curious, I'd like to hear your explanation on how that's not true, if you believe it's not true.
Yeah. You all should, this is an important argument, because it is the argument made against raising the minimum wage. I think the answer is that, at least in my country, raising the minimum wage, I think we need to do it, because just to be blunt about it, because it is the right thing to do. I mean, it's not right to have millions of people who work full time and live in poverty. I think we ought to make a principle of the Democratic Party and our nation that no American will work full time and live in poverty. Period. It should not happen. But there are things we can do to help employers. For example, one of the things that John and I worked very hard on in the campaign was to convey our health care plan. It's actually, in fairness, it was his health care plan. It wasn't mine. I had a different health care plan when I was running in the primaries. But he had a terrific health care plan that would have provided great help and benefit to employers in the cost of health care. So if you do that in combination with raising the minimum wage and creating a level playing field for unions to be able to bargain, which I think is also the right thing to do, then you alleviate some of the financial stress that's created by raising the minimum wage for employers. So I think you can offset the cash flow problem for employers, but I think you ought to, all those things ought to be done together. I mean, not just raising the minimum wage, not just organizing campaigns. We need to help employers and workers with health care costs, which are, as you I'm sure know, are a huge component of trying to do business in the United States today.
Well, I mean, we instituted a minimum wage and we raised the minimum wage, and the level of unemployment is the lowest it's ever been, and the level of employment is the highest it's ever been. I'm really sorry we won't be able to get around to everybody, but maybe we have the gentleman in the middle there. I think we're going to have time for one or maybe most two more questions after that.
Hi, I'm Alex Voladeras at the University of Warwick. Thank you, Senator, for being here. Well, my question is really simple. How far would you be prepared to go to spread democracy around the world?
Democracy is different things to different people. And I don't think it is the responsibility of America to spread our form of government around the world. I think it is. I think it is a responsibility of America and Britain and other free nations to allow countries around the world to make their own decisions about the form of government in which they're able to participate, in which they're able to freely choose their own leaders, in which they can establish freedom of speech, in which they can establish a rule of law and civil society. And I think that, and I said this in the speech, it wasn't just words. I think that it's more than military force. It's more than muscle. And this sort of goes to the question that the young man asked me up here earlier on, which is, do we actually represent for the rest of the world the kind of ideal that we need to represent to be sort of a shining example of what democracy can and should be? And there's no doubt that we have faltered in some ways on that front, which is some of which he asked about. But there are other ways in which we have managed to do that. And I think we have to constantly be working to be better and be a better example for the rest of the world. I said during the campaign that we didn't talk about this much, but with respect to our own citizens, this administration had a policy on what they called enemy combatants that allowed an American citizen to be arrested, kept in prison indefinitely, to never see a lawyer, to never get a hearing, never get their day in court, and just be kept there forever. It's just wrong, period. Represents everything America should not stand for. And I think those things matter. Those examples matter for us.
Senator, would you like to choose your last one or two questioners, please?
I thought I wasn't going to get it in, but a good friend of mine, Josh Friday, worked for your campaign, and he's yes. He's a big advocate of the whole thing, and very eager to see you run again. Now, I'm just wondering, with regards to egalitarianism and the role the internet played on this occasion, which seemed to be a big fundraising machine and being able to reach into the disenfranchised, just wondering, purely from a politically strategic point, how do you see the internet in 2008?
You've talked about politically?
Politically, campaigning, fundraising.
Well, I think one of the great things that happened in this campaign was, I mean, I don't actually know what the percentage ended up being of the funding for our presidential campaign from internet contributions, but it was a huge part of funding of our campaign. And it was such a good thing. And it was such a good thing because it spread grassroots democracy. Instead of having campaigns funded by big check donors, and you go to these big political fundraising events, a huge amount of the money was actually coming in over the internet because people believed in the cause. And I think it's actually transformed the way political campaigns will be funded in America in the future. I think increasingly large amounts of the campaign will be funded by contributions over the internet. And I think that's a very good thing. It's a very good thing.
I'm going to pick somebody else.
Sure. How about this gentleman right here?
Can you just wait for the mic? Thank you.
My name's Alan Gottlieb. I'm a physician. And, in fact, I spent 3 years studying at Duke University, just down the road from you.
Yeah.
I can tell you how you could have won the election. I'm sure you...
It's too late.
Well, use it. You can use it next time. I'm sure you saw Michael Moore's film, Fahrenheit 9/11. There was a clip in that where he showed George Bush addressing a Republican fundraising dinner, in which Bush said, you are the haves and the have-mores. Some people say you are the elite. I say you are my base. Now, if every person in America saw that, surely any right-thinking person would not vote for him.
I might be wrong about this, but I suspect the people who saw Michael Moore's movie, we got a pretty fair percentage of those votes. I think we should take a few more questions. How about, I want to do a couple in the, yes. Yes, ma'am, right here. Here it comes.
And you talked about China and India being on the brink of innovation, and that's why they're picking up. Well, when I look at China and India, I see innovation, but I also see rising inequalities and rising disparities in very polarized countries.
Yep.
So as far as the UK and the developed world and even the developing world pushing towards the brink of innovation, how do we reconcile efficiency and equity?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think it's a very serious challenge for all of us. And you see, and I did talk about it in this speech. You see, in America, the disparity between the haves and the have-nots has gotten significantly worse. I don't personally believe that's an accident. I think it's a result of decisions and choices that have been made, And when you're focused on trying to compete and trying to compete globally, I think what I was at least trying to say, I don't know if I said it clearly, what I was trying to say was we have to be forward-looking. We will not change the fact that America and Britain are, we have to compete. Our young people, all of us, we have to compete. The world's not going, we're going to have to be able to compete with the young people who, by the way, are doing the right thing in China and India by getting more education, by being more industrious, by trying to build a better life for themselves. But we have to make sure that those kind of opportunities are available to everybody. You might remember that during my own campaign for the nomination, I talked about two Americas and the difference between an America for the few who are doing very well and then for everybody else. I mean, one of the great challenges, and there are many pieces of this, some of which we've already talked about today, one of the great challenges that we face, because I happen to believe that a strong, growing, vibrant middle class, in other words, lifting people out of poverty into the middle class, strengthening the middle class, dealing with their insecurities, including their economic insecurities, is critical for democracy to take hold and to be strong. Because it's just common sense, and you see, we've seen it happen in history. If you become a country of a very small number of very rich, and then everybody else, it is very hard to maintain democracy. So a strong middle class is critical to democracy, and that's why lifting people out of poverty, creating assets, raising wages, all the things that we've been talking about are important. You can't do any of these things in isolation. I was asked, I had a meeting earlier today, and someone said, well, now, you think in the future that foreign policy is going to get the same attention as economic policy because of 9/11, more attention on foreign policy, et cetera, in future presidential elections? My question is, what's the difference? What is the difference? There is no difference. I mean, these things are completely together. They are totally integrated. For us to be, for America to compete, we have to compete globally. We have to be thinking not only in terms of the military threat created by North Korea moving forward with their nuclear weapons program, by Iran's movement forward. We have to be thinking about what is the effect of growth and economic strength in China and India on the American economy, on the British economy. How do we compete not only with those countries, but I suspect there will be many others emerging over the coming years. How is it that we compete? How do we remain strong? We have huge advantages in America right now. But for us to maintain our leadership role, we have to maintain those advantages. And if you look at, for example, a place like China, where they graduated between 300,000 and 400,000 engineers last year, while in America we graduated roughly 10% to 15% of that. I mean, it's very, very hard for us to compete when we lose our edge in being able to do the research and being able to invest in graduate education in those areas. So, bottom line is we have to do both at the same time, I think is what it boils down to, which
Senator,
is integrate
Senator,
these
your,
things.
Your assistants are getting very sweaty. And
is he?
I think that you have to get
He's
you
trying
onto
to make
the,
a stop.
We have to get you on to the next engagement.
No more?
Sir.
Oh, come on. These people came and waited. They ought to be able to ask a question. How about this young man right back here?
Right. Thank you very much, Mr. Edwards. My question is very simple. What will President Edwards do in his first 24 hours in office?
I can tell you this. People ask me, what is your campaign? Well, first of all, most of you probably know this, in my own family, we have a job to do, which is to get my wife well. You know, she's been... And my campaign is to eradicate poverty. That is where my heart and soul is right now. It's where I'm spending my energy and my time, and that's what I'm going to stay focused on, and we'll just see what happens out in the future, whenever that is. But thank you for the question. I appreciate the question. Yes, sir, right here.
Thank you very much. John Berg, former chairman of the school. We've just spent 3 days with lifelong American friends. He, a retired professor from Duke University, and both of them come from Charleston, and they both vote Democrat, and they both voted for you. they are deeply concerned about the alliance between the neocons and the fundamentalists and the erosion of individual liberty since 9/11.
Yeah.
And they think the situation is worse than it was under McCarthy. And I'd be very interested in your own assessment about the situation and what the chances are and the methods of reversing the situation.
Yeah. Well, as we've seen over the course of human history, the greatest threat to liberty and individual freedoms is at a time of insecurity, people being worried, a time of war. And that's what happened as a result of 9/11. And it's what resulted in the drawing back on some of the very liberties that I think are what America's supposed to be about. So the answer to your question is we just have to be out there. You had another part of your question where you talked about fundamentalists, I think. I'm trying to remember what that was. I think on the liberty front, the most important thing for us to do is, number one, remind Americans what it is our country is based on, what it is we believe in, what is the bedrock of America, why we exist, and call on their American pride to do the right thing, even though they're under stress. Now, my own view about this is that you can't count on, in a time of passion and heat, you can't always count on people to do the regular folks to do the right thing. It's when leadership really matters. It's when you need leaders who have the strength and the vision to understand that in the process of fighting terrorism, for example, you can't give away the things that you're supposed to be fighting for. And I think that's why elections matter. It's why I'm having leaders who have strength and backbone and conviction matter. And you're right about one thing. It is clear that one of the things that's happened with the Republican Party, and this is what a lot of authors in America have talked about, is it's sort of a cultural populism. Using social issues to try to drive a wedge between the very people who would fight for these folks and then their own interests, and that's what they have attempted to do, and it's why we have to have such a clear, strong statement of what we believe in and who we're fighting for and who we're going to fight for every day, because it's what the truth of the matter is, they've got division down. They're good at that. We should be about unifying. We should be about trying to bring everybody into the circle of opportunity and real chances to do what they're capable of doing and not giving up the things that America is supposed to represent. I mean, that's what these campaigns and elections are about. I think you all are going to get tired sooner or later. Yes, sir, in the back.
Senator, you spoke very evocatively about America's need to...
Actually, I was pointing... I'll be glad to... I wasn't pointing to you, though. I want to make sure this gentleman... Why don't you go ahead, and then I'll let him ask his question.
Okay, well, you spoke very evocatively about America's need to fight poverty at home and abroad. But there's times when those two can seem mutually exclusive.
Yes.
The subsidies to the cotton mills of the American South keep a great deal of African countries away from the kind of prosperity that you say it is America's moral obligation to give them.
Yes.
I want to know how you personally feel you can reconcile those two.
Well, there is, you're right, there's a tension and a friction between what are you going to do for people at home who are struggling. And there's a limited amount of resources that you can have. I have, you deserve to know, I have supported farm subsidies. We have a huge farming operation in my own state of North Carolina, and I have met with farmers all across the country who are having a terrible time making ends meet. That doesn't mean this is not, I understand exactly the issue and the question, I'm only speaking for myself. I think that for the time being, it's important for that safety net to be available to American farmers. And it's what I've stood for, and it's what I still believe. And now we'll let this gentleman in the back.
My name is Anthony, and I'm from London Metropolitan University, but I'm from Ghana. And my question to you is, with regards to, as you talk about poverty, which you say is on your heart very much, and if you are to be in office for 24 hours, that's what you're going to do. My question is, don't you think it's a laugh when developed countries or the GAs talk about doubling aids to third world countries without paying much attention to the real issues, which of trade barriers and, as my fellow colleagues put across, subsidies. Don't you think these are the sort of things that will create wealth, that will sort of a livelihood for those people in the third world countries to rely upon? And also, do you think America, in this competitive global world, America be willing to do those things? And my other question is, which is very simple and quick, is has America got the right to tell North Korea or Iran not to have a nuclear weapon?
Yes. on the second issue, let me do that one first, then I'll go back to your first one. On the second issue, I just think it is such an enormous threat to the Middle East, to the world, for people like Kim Jong-il to have access to nuclear weapons. I mean, this is a dangerous, dangerous man. And we've actually seen under the Bush administration the march forward on nuclear capability in North Korea. So I think the work that's being done right now, and one of the things that I was actually critical of Dick Cheney about in our vice presidential debate was, you know, both in North Korea and in Iran, in North Korea it's been left to China and other countries in Asia to deal with the threat, and in the case of Iran, it's largely been left to the Europeans to deal with the threat of their development of nuclear weapons. And it is true that the Europeans have an economic leverage which we no longer have because of our sanctions regime against Iran. I've forgotten what your other question was. Subsidies, the same answers to that question, but you had something else, if I remember correctly. I know what it was. One of the things that I hear from the administration, now if you step back from this about on the whole aid question, George Bush promised a significant amount of money for aid to Africa. A lot of us were very surprised by that, but it did happen. I was there when he said it in his State of the Union address. But here's what's happened. He promised a certain amount. Then he asked the Congress for less than he committed to. The Congress gave him less than he asked for. And a minor amount of the money that Congress allocated has actually been used. So the result of that is America is not, along with a lot of other countries, in my judgment, done what should be done with respect to aid to Africa. And what's happening now is the administration wants to talk a great deal about governance issues in Africa, which are serious issues. That should be a piece of what we're trying to do, but it can't operate independent of the financial aid. Those two things have to work in combination. That's the way we can be successful over the long term. We have to make sure that our aid is actually getting to the people who need the aid, which is why the governance issues matter. You want to say something else? What was it? I was trying to remember what your other question was.
The question I asked was, in this global competitive world, yes, where everyone is fighting for economic strength and things like that, I'm saying that it's been proven that years and years, the developed world have been trying to give aid to third world countries in order for them to develop, and it's not wet. So my question is, don't you think the real issues are rather the removal of subsidies and barriers to trade and the international trading system, free trade system, which are the race rather than the issues of giving aid, which of course has been proven doesn't work with regards to development.
Well, I don't agree. You're right that trade certainly matters. You can make a perfectly legitimate argument about the subsidy issue, which I've heard over and over. But it's also true that aid makes a difference. I don't agree with you that aid doesn't make a difference. If you know that the money is getting to the people who need it, and if America and other wealthy countries are fulfilling their responsibility, I think it can make a difference. The question is, are we doing what needs to be done to have an impact, us along with the rest of the nations that are well to do?
Senator, could this possibly be the last question?
Well, I wanted to give these folks a chance to ask. Let me. Why don't we do this gentleman right here?
Hi, my name is Jamie. I'm from Southern California. As America adjusts to the new challenges of the new century, surely it makes sense that it should reform Social Security. Do you think that it should be reformed, and if so, how?
It depends on what you mean by reform. If you mean privatize, no. We should not privatize Social Security. That would be an enormous mistake. I don't. First of all, what the president is proposing is to borrow trillions of dollars, send the country deeper and deeper into debt. It's going to result in a cut in benefits. It does nothing to strengthen Social Security over the long term. Social Security is there because Democrats created it, and we believed then and we believe now that people who've worked all their lives should be able to grow old with dignity without having to depend on their children and grandchildren. It's not a complicated thing. It's there to be a safety net. And to the extent that you privatize it, take money out of the system, that is not what we should do, at least in my view, not what we should do with Social Security. I think that's an enormous mistake. And I think by right now you're seeing the American people respond in that way. It's part, I might add, you know, if what you care about, if your big issue now is poverty, you know, we have about 9% of our seniors live in poverty every day. It would be just under half, probably about 40%, without Social Security. So Social Security has been one of the great anti-poverty programs in American history. And it's really important that it stay there for people who depend on it every day just to be able to get by. I think they're really about to have a hissy fit over here now. I want to say to all of you before. Did you have something else you wanted to say? I just wanted to say one last thing. I wanted to say thank you. Thank you.
I was
going
to say I got a meeting to go to.
As do I. But I wanted to be certain that people had a chance to ask their question. I apologize to those of you who didn't get to ask your question. One thing we should do is leave our email address. Send us your question. I'll get you an answer. We'll make sure that you get an answer. I mean, you took the time to be here with me. I want to make sure I've responded to your questions. It was my honor to be here with you. Thank you.